Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, nestled right near Norristown, PA, and King of Prussia, PA, which is sometimes known for its mall, and otherwise known for its history with Valley Forge, being right near Philadelphia. But today, I'm talking to another guest on our podcast who has run for office in a state that seems to make history a lot, one way or another. She is from New Hampshire. Her name is Jennifer Burnett. And maybe you've heard of New Hampshire because there are about 300 people running for president who are going through there. And there's a little bit more than 300 people who are in the state house in New Hampshire as well. All of them making a difference, making an impact on policy. And I'm looking forward to our conversation today. Before I get into our conversation, make sure to listen to past episodes of the You Should Run podcast, where you can hear people who've run for judge, borough council, mayor, Congress, and whatnot, all sorts of different perspectives. And if you're listening, hopefully you'll be encouraged that wherever you are, whether you're in Pennsylvania like me, New Hampshire like Jennifer, or Missouri, or wherever, that you decide to run for office too. So with that little introduction, I'm excited to talk to Jennifer Burnett. Jennifer, thank you for joining the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we have a mutual friend. And that's how a lot of my guests have come on, is also through Charles, but also mutual friends in general. But I don't know you very well. So what, have you always been a political-minded person?
Yes, I grew up in a very politically active household. Both my parents were very politically active. My mother had a bit of a lull after the 1968 Democratic Convention. She got very upset about that, but she was still involved somehow in politics. So I grew up with it.
And so you, and New Hampshire, I feel like you can't really get away from politics there, right?
No, I always say that politics is a state sport.
Right. Well, you don't have anything else, right?
Well, people follow Boston teams usually.
Right, but I don't want to talk about Boston teams because I don't like them.
Okay.
I live in Philly. I can't like the Boston teams. That doesn't sound right. But eventually you ran for office, and you've run for office a few times, right?
Yes, I've run for office a few times. That's true. I first ran on 2006 because I was asked to run pretty much at the last minute, because in New Hampshire sometimes, because there are 400 seats for state representatives, sometimes it's challenging to get enough people to run to fill the ticket, as you can imagine. And it's a volunteer legislature, basically. So sometimes, either one or both parties in different places can have to scramble to find people to run.
And that was part of the reason I was interested in talking with you. So New Hampshire has over 400 representatives, right?
400 House members and 24 state senators.
So the state senate, is that like where the real action is, or is it in both chambers?
There's action in both chambers, for sure.
And had you thought about running for state office before that, or is it, like you said, they just needed a body?
Well, I used to follow the local reps in the local newspapers, and sometimes I would say, oh, I could do that, or I would like to work on that committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got involved. I wasn't really involved with electoral politics so much. I was more of an issues advocate for most of my teenage and adult life. And then a bunch of us in our little town in New Hampshire got involved with the Howard Dean campaign.
Oh, yeah, I remember that was big.
2004.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that group, after Dean dropped out, we kept our group going, and we created a Democratic committee in the town that we were in, which is Temple, New Hampshire. And then a couple of years later, our current state rep, we had three Republicans and a Democrat representing the district, and she called the town chair at the time to ask him if he would run, and he didn't want to, so he told her to call me, and we had a very long conversation about about the importance of running, because in New Hampshire, if you don't fill your slate, somebody from the other party can get a certain amount of signatures. Back then, I think it was only 10 signatures.
Right.
Of people from the other party, then they could run on both sides of the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And there used to be straight ticket voting. There was straight ticket voting in 2006 still. So that could, be to one party or the other's advantage if they got on both sides, or at least one candidate got on both sides, because whatever the straight ticket, they would get that vote.
Yeah, that happens here too.
Yeah, so that's what really convinced me to run, was to fill the slate and give people a choice. And then it turned out to be a wave election year in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and I didn't expect to win, quite frankly. I just thought it would be a good experience, get to know people, talk about the issues. But surprisingly enough, I think it was after midnight, the town chair called me and said, "Guess what? You're a state representative." So I was like, oh, I didn't really expect to win, but it was wonderful. It was the first time in 132 years that the governor, the executive council, and the legislature were in Democratic hands.
So you said that you were like, oh, I would like to, you'd always been interested in some sort of policies and issues on a state level. What were some of the things that were interesting for you then?
Well, disability rights and education are two issues that were of interest to me then. And I got put on the Health and Human Services and Elderly Affairs Committee in my first term. And I really, really enjoyed that work, and I really enjoyed the subject matter. I had originally asked to be on the education committee because I had a master's of education at the time, but I got put, Health and Human Services was my second choice, and I really, really loved it, and the ability to help people and to change policies to get better services for our most vulnerable citizens. I'm very passionate about that.
So that was your second choice, and that worked out. Was it a learning experience then, being not just a candidate and running, but then seeing these things you had thought about as committees and then actually being on them and doing them?
Yes, it's a very steep learning curve. One of my colleagues at the time was saying it's like getting an MBA in a couple of weeks.
Right.
Because there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot of different issues, stakeholders, constituencies. So it's a very steep learning curve.
So there, and does, with New Hampshire being so many people running, is it always a new learning curve because you're always having to educate new people? I imagine there's a lot of attrition. There's a lot of new people every 2 years, right?
Yeah, I think about a third of the House switches out every term, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but that's what I think is the number. But there are a lot of people that serve many terms, so people try to organize their lives so they can do it
right
in various ways.
And so is one of the challenges then for New Hampshire, which I think even though it's unique there, but also true in other places, because while you're a volunteer legislature, there's a lot of other legislatures where it's a part-time legislature, which is very frequent, or doesn't pay a lot. So the people who are there a lot have the kind of jobs that let them be there a lot, right? That the people that use it as a regular running over and over again, they have some sort of job that makes it possible.
Yes.
So you ran, and it was a surprise in 2006, and I think people forget, like, that Howard Dean was a very motivating thing for a lot of people. Right now we see, like, both the president and everyone running for president and other things are using social media, but he was the dean of the blogs, right? The first internet candidate.
Yeah, and actually, in that freshman class of 2006 that I came in with, many of us had been supporters of Howard Dean, and that got us involved. So he really did have a big influence, even though he didn't wind up getting the nomination in terms of organizing and motivating people to run.
Right. I remember, Dean, my first campaign was in Iowa in 2002. So he was there a bunch of times, and I had no idea who he was when I first started that job out there. And I was like, wow, this guy, shouldn't everyone be supporting him? He seems to be the one with the energy and the, you know, the enthusiasm and the interest right here. So you ran, but you didn't stay in the legislature forever, right? You had some ups and downs.
Right. The next election, the district that I ran in was a Republican, you know, it had a Republican advantage in terms of voter registration. So the next election, 2008, I lost.
Which is interesting because New Hampshire, I mean, Obama won New Hampshire, and he won it pretty significantly, right?
I don't remember. I have to look it up. I don't know if he won it significantly. New Hampshire is a very purple state. It's
which feels weird to anyone not for New Hampshire, because I know the motto is "Live free or die," which is everyone, you know, finds interesting, but you know, you look at New England, and it just seems like liberal New England. Elizabeth Warren, like, oh, she's a Massachusetts liberal, or John Kerry, or whatever. And then you look at Vermont and Howard Dean, and you just kind of assume that New England is New England. But New Hampshire, just like anyone else running in any other small race, it's a very unique place, right?
Yes. But New England is very town oriented, so it's town by town.
Right. Yeah, my wife is from Providence, Rhode Island, so we go up there. We have been to New Hampshire a couple times, but it is interesting that, like, here it feels regional in the Philly area, but that up there is just like every exit is some other new different place. And people wouldn't expect that if they don't know the area too well.
Right, and each town has its own personality, even if certain towns are similar demographically or historically, they take on their own personalities in a way. So it's fun to canvass here, even though it's hard in the rural areas, because of sometimes you go up somebody's driveway and they'd say, oh, I'll vote for you because you just came up my 2-mile-long driveway. And nobody ever does that.
You'd canvassed before you ran for office, right? Because you said you were involved in the presidential stuff, and you'd always been political.
Well, I actually, in 2006, I didn't canvass. I had really didn't know what I was doing too much. We did public events, you know, meet the candidates. People in New Hampshire tend to go to the recycling center, also known as the dump, and meet people there.
Oh yeah, of course.
People, so we did that. But I didn't really do the door-to-door thing until actually 2010. I ran again, and I was lucky enough that year to do a candidate training that was put on by Wellstone Action and SEIU.
Yes.
Down in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really, really good training. So the two other elections, I really didn't know what I was doing. So, and then after that training in the 2010 election, I really felt like, oh, now I know what I was doing. I got over my trepidation about canvassing, because I was actually very uncomfortable knocking on people's doors, knocking on strangers' doors.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, seeing them at the dump or in front of the post office or something seemed to me less onerous on them.
Right.
But then I talked to some people who had been canvassing. I don't know if they had them in Pennsylvania, but here in 2008 they had people wearing purple shirts with healthcare. I'm a healthcare voter.
I was one of them.
Oh, okay. So I met some somebody who was doing that, and he really coached me too into learning to love canvassing.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of canvassing with my running mates in 2010, but that was a wave election year in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So the makeup of the legislature after that election was 300 Republicans and 100 Democrats, more or less, maybe even less than 100. So, except the Governor Lynch won, so we had a Democratic governor, and all of the other elected bodies were veto-proof majority Republican. So that was a rousing loss for Team Blue. But what happened was one of my opponents became the Speaker of the House, and he hired his running mate to be his chief of staff. So that person had been elected, so he resigned his seat, and so they had a special election in May of 2011, which I ran in. We met as a group, the people who had originally run, and we decided I should run for that since I had held the seat before.
Mm-hmm.
And that special election was a referendum on the speaker, and a lot of different constituencies were unhappy with some of the things he was doing. So everything was very focused on that race, and I won that election. And it was very interesting to serve during those years. So the Republicans held veto-proof majorities, and it was also redistricting time. So they controlled redistricting, and they would disagree with me, but they gerrymandered as much as they could. I mean, we only have two congressional seats, so it's really hard to gerrymander that.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as they could do with the Senate, the Executive Council, and the House, they did. And they took the town that I lived in and put it with the most Republican town in the state. So I went from an R+7 district to an R+26 district.
Wow.
Yeah. So needless to say, I worked really hard in 2012. I did a lot of canvassing. I knocked on as many doors as I could in that town that was very Republican majority, but I just couldn't overcome the numbers. I did as well as a Democrat could do there, but it just wasn't going to go any farther. So I was sidelined.
But this is like a lot of up and downs, even more than I expected.
Yeah, it's sort of like how the
country,
how the elections have been in general the last few elections, you know, because also we have 2-year cycles for everybody.
Right.
So the governor, the state senate, the state house, and the executive council, everybody's up for election every 2 years, so it can give those swings.
Do you think that that's a positive? Like, in Pennsylvania, our state house is just like Congress, so it's every 2 years for the state house, and then the state senators, they're 4-year terms, and so half of them are up in 2 years, then half, like in 2020, and then half of them in 2022, and then the governor's every 4 years, like, which goes with the year that's not the presidency. But so there's some consistency throughout. There's always some people who are going to be there over and over again. But so there's pluses and minuses either way. Do you see that being a plus or minus for New Hampshire?
Well, I used to think it was a plus, but then when I saw what happened during, you know, the 2011-12 session, where a lot of things, you know, a lot of policies happened that I disagree with, like, they repealed the state minimum wage, so we don't have a minimum wage in New Hampshire. It defaults to the federal minimum wage. They had total control over the redistricting, and the governor vetoed the House redistricting plan, and they overrode it. So if there had been, you know, four-year terms for the Senate or staggered terms, it would have been a little more balanced, I think.
Right, and you could have planned ahead.
In that particular biennium. So, and then the following 2012, I believe the House went to a Democratic majority, the Senate remained a Republican majority, and Maggie Hassan was elected governor.
So you've been there for redistricting, and that's one of the things is really important this election. It's 2020 coming up, and so it's a census year, which means redistricting will happen right after that. And the part of the reason Republicans have held Congress in the last decade was because they redistricted after 2010. So,
right. Yeah, because New Hampshire wasn't the only state that had that happen in 2010.
Right. Obviously. It was all, they saw it as a priority. So you saw firsthand what gerrymandering and redistricting do on a state level, also obviously on a federal level. Why is it important now that people wake up, especially progressives, and say, we have to take these state legislative races seriously?
Because a lot happens on the state level. I remember I saw a headline on the blog Daily Coast, mm-hmm. quite a number of years ago now, and it was about state government, and it says, or state elections, says, as the state government, I might not be sexy, but I can rock your world. And that's really the importance of state-level races, because a lot of policy gets decided by the states.
Like what? What gets to why? And that's why, you
well,
know,
Medicaid
I've talked to
policy is, I mean, they have to have things approved at CMS at the federal level, but you know how some states had Medicaid expansion, some states didn't.
Mm-hmm. What have you seen that, because you were surprised, like you said, and I think most people when they run for office, they're surprised at the challenges of it, but then they're also surprised at what they can and can't do. Was there anything that you were surprised that the state was so influential on, like, as an issue? You said, like, Medicaid expansion, which when you first ran wasn't a thing.
Right.
So, did anything like seem like, wow, this is really why these state races are so important?
Well, I always realized that they were important.
Right.
But the good thing in New Hampshire about having such a large house, and one of the reasons that they decided to have it that way, is that you'll run into your legislator, you know, in the post office or in the grocery store, and just be able to talk to them. And I find, in general, even, like our state senators or even our congresspeople, like they're very approachable. Whereas when I grew up in New York State, and I didn't even know who my state legislator was half the time. You know, the New York Assembly, they weren't really present. And I think in New Hampshire, there's a lot more dialogue, hopefully, with constituents and people being present in their towns and cities in a way that's really positive. And so I can't say I was surprised by it, but I think a lot of people are, because everybody's always focused on national and federal things, because that's where the television news focuses, obviously.
Right. Well, and the television news obviously focuses on New Hampshire because there's a presidential primary coming up.
Oh, right, yeah. They focus on the primary and all the, I read somewhere a columnist compared it to Brigadoon. It comes out of the mists every few years. But, yeah, so that is true.
Can you walk, like, you said you can, you as a constituent in New Hampshire, if you go to the post office or you go to the local store, there's a good chance that you could run into your state legislator at any time, because they're regular people and it's so many. But at this point, can you bump into someone running for president or their surrogate, like, every day in New Hampshire?
I wouldn't say bump into them. There's so many of them right now.
Right.
And there seems to be such, I don't know how to put it. You know, people are so interested, and there's so many more people interested in politics than even, you know, several years ago, that most of the campaign events are very large. Like, I remember going to a house or going to a small restaurant and seeing Howard Dean with Rob Reiner. Like, he was at this little restaurant called the Pub Restaurant in Keene, and they were just right there. And now that restaurant wouldn't be able to fit all the people that would want to see any of the candidates.
Right, like, you know, you see the rallies that Andrew Yang has, and I'm not advocating for Andrew Yang, but it's like, who the heck was this guy 10 minutes ago? And he's got 1,000 people at a rally just on a Tuesday.
Right. Yeah, so this election cycle feels different than previous ones in terms of being able to be up close and personal with the candidates in the same way. I was at a backyard barbecue with Hillary Clinton back in 2015. So there are not any of, and that she was pretty, you know, that was Hillary Clinton back then, and there just wouldn't be the ability for somebody to, unless you had a very huge backyard, and a lot of people do own large acreage around here, but, you know, it would be 500 people wanting to get into something like that.
So do you think that that is a plus for how we pick our president then? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who are skeptical of Iowa and New Hampshire. I spent time in Iowa for politics. You're in New Hampshire. But I feel like if California and New York or Texas and Florida, these huge states, were number one, then what would matter most is who had the best TV ads, not that retail aspect that seems to drive what makes people good legislators in New Hampshire, right?
Yes, I think the retail aspect is important because people can really hone their message. I saw Elizabeth Warren earlier in the year in the winter, and then I saw her recently, and she's better at her message. I could see that improvement in how she spoke and how she presented herself and the clarity of her message. So that's really good to see over time with candidates. You could see people grow. You could see how people react to different questions in a way that people can't do in a larger state because of the geography, and then the ad buys, and like you said, it would be television commercials. So there is something to be said for the retail politics side of it, at least at the beginning of the race.
Right. I think I find it very valuable. I've been to, not this year, but in my first parts of politics, just seeing people like Howard Dean or John Kerry go to small things and before they have their big rallies. I think that does have a positive thing, and it obviously, do you think that then translates to you guys in New Hampshire maybe being more moderate in your policies too, because you're all so connected to your constituencies?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. We're moderate.
Like, does that make, do you think that because everyone's connected to their constituencies that, like, Republicans aren't separated from their neighbors, that there are a lot of people who might vote differently than they would if they never had to talk to their neighbors? Like in the state
Senate. Yeah, that's interesting. The parties right now, I mean, it is reflected in our legislature, the polarization for sure. So they feel, you know, the Republicans feel like they're representing their constituency with their votes.
Right. It feels almost disappointing that way, right? Like, you see people who, I mean, there's good and bad people in any party, but you see what's going on with the Republicans and Donald Trump and, like, that. It's like a cult, and they're like, all right, well, I'm going to talk to Steve. He's my state rep or my mayor or whatever, and he's not going to buy into that. And they're like, no,
yeah,
you do.
They don't. Yeah, they do see people more as individuals that way, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, I just find, and because you've been involved in politics in some way, shape, or form for a while, including at this political level since before this current weirdness, it does feel so weird, right? Like, you're like, this isn't what I thought people would be like. Or maybe I'm just wrong.
Well, I'm not surprised at Trump being like Trump, because I grew up in New York.
Right.
So what he's doing isn't... I mean, what's surprising is how extreme it is, even, you know, in a... It's like in a different context. Like, he was doing that as a millionaire real estate developer who was hanging out with celebrities, but doing it as the president, it really makes it seem... way more bizarre.
Right. Yep. It's not, you expect differently, and you expect differently of your legislators when you get to meet them. But you get to meet people.
Yeah,
regularly.
Nobody in the legislature is acting like that. I mean, I do things that I disagree with on their policies, but I'm sure a lot of them support him.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bar has certainly been set pretty low, I guess, right?
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting election cycle in 2020, for sure.
I believe that was a Chinese curse.
I don't know, but it's, because there's a lot at stake. So...
Well, like you said, there's a lot at stake, not just at the presidential level where New Hampshire matters significantly, but there's a lot at stake on the state level, and that's why...
Oh, absolutely. I think that was the strategy, actually, that led to the 2010 elections in so many states having Republican majorities. I mean, we saw what happened in Wisconsin with Scott Walker and the people taking over the state house. I think that was over the so-called, what they call right to work, and we call right to work for less.
Right. So we know it's very important, but why? That's why it's important to vote. It's important to organize and support candidates that we care about. But it's also obviously important. That's why people should run for office. So what?
Absolutely. I think running for office is such a learning experience. And I think people should run whether or not they think they're going to win, even if they're in a district that is very challenging. Because sometimes you don't know, because if your name's on the ballot, you still have a chance to win the election, even if it's a long shot.
Right.
I don't regret doing all the canvassing and all the work that I did in the election where it was a severe long shot for me, because it's nice to talk to people. There are people, I knocked on their doors and they said that's the first time anybody running for office asked them what they thought, and they appreciated that. And it's good to know what your neighbors are thinking and what's important to people. And, you know, if people are, you know, if somebody's concerned about whatever issue they're concerned about, whether it's a school issue, then run for the school board. Or if it's a local issue, city council, town council. We have, in our towns, it's called select boards. It used to be called select men.
Right.
That, at the town level. So there's all different places to, all different levels of office to run for. And, you know, you don't have to start at Congress. Can always start at a more local level, and really dig into those issues because they're all connected.
Right. They're all definitely connected. And, you know, if you're like yourself, you're not in Congress or you're not in the Senate, but when you run for those local offices, one day you might run for something else and you'll have become a better candidate and better official before you get to that stage.
Yeah, right now, for example, our congressman from the first congressional district, Chris Pappas, when I first met him, he was, I think he was working for the Democratic Party, and he helped me file for office. Mm-hmm. And then I think he had been a state rep at one point, and then he was the county treasurer. Then he ran for executive council, which is a pretty powerful position in New Hampshire. We have a very weak governor's office.
Right.
And the executive council is a council of five individuals that are elected from five districts in the state who have to approve all the governor's appointments and all contracts, I think, above $10,000. So it's a, I always say that it's one of the most important offices that many people never heard of. So he was on the executive council for a few terms and then ran for Congress. And now he's a congressman. I think he's doing a great job.
Good. Well, so that's what we know. We know that every office matters. You never know what the next step will be. And the person who's going to be elected president in 2032 could right now just be some man or woman who's never run for office before.
Exactly. And even, you know, there's so many ways to serve the community, but I think running for office is a very satisfying way to do it. Running and getting elected is, because, of course, if you don't get elected, you can't do different things, but you can always be writing letters to the editor and bringing up things if you run and you're not successful the first time. I know people that have run multiple times for office, and often they're successful at some point. Keep going.
Well, I hope if you're listening, you decide to try what you can do and keep going. That's what Jennifer Burnett did. She decided to keep going through sometimes luck, sometimes perseverance and changing her ways. I appreciate that you've run for office, Jennifer, and that you're making a difference today. So thank you so much for doing that and for hopefully inspiring other people to run for office too.
Yes, I hope so.
So if you're listening, make sure to check out some of our past podcast episodes, share them, suggest your guest recommendations. We just recently put up a map of states that we've hosted on this page. Jennifer is the first person from New Hampshire, but there's 10,000 more elected officials from New Hampshire we could ask. So, you know, offer your ideas wherever you are. And if you're listening, maybe you should run for office too.